Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
And joined this week by a couple of great guests. We've got Colin Lynch. Hey, Colin.
Hey, Raj. How you doing?
Great to hear your voice. Everybody knows Colin. You're a senior global reporter at DevEx. You cover all things UN and much more than that. It's great to have you. And then we have Ode Darnell. Hi, Ode.
Hi, Raj. Hi, Colin. How are you?
Great to hear your voice, hey. Ode. And Ode, you're at the Stimson Center. And you're a research associate there. You work on the Reimagining U.S. Grand Strategy Program. I love the name of that. But you also lead the Global South in the World Order Project, which is right at the heart of a lot of the localization questions we're often talking about. And we had some reporting on localization this week, which we will get into in a second. And I'm eager to hear your take on it. But let me start with you, Colin, on some of your ongoing reporting on UNRWA and the humanitarian response in the Gaza Strip. You had a big story this week trying to bring kind of home the actual reality of what fight over UNRWA's role is leading to on the ground. Maybe you can tell people a little bit about what you found.
Right. So first, I mean, UNRWA is the major, you know, UN Palestinian sort of refugee humanitarian aid support operation in Gaza and throughout the region. They have sort of a massive personnel, some 13,000 Palestinian workers. They function pretty much like a government ministry, doing health, education, and humanitarian assistance. So Israel has long kind of resented UNRWA's role because they are the they basically sort of maintain and preserve the whole question of the right of return by, you know, what is now millions of Palestinians, and Israel is very, you know, upset about that, and so that has been a point of tension well before the present conflict. So Israel, at the beginning of the conflict, made claims that that a number of, some a dozen UNRWA members were involved in the October 7th mass killings in southern Israel, and that, you know, somewhere along 10% more have some links to the Hamas military wing. You know, all of these allegations have not been fully confirmed or verified by the UN. There are investigations ongoing. However, Israel since then has basically taken the position that UNRWA can play no role, particularly in distributing assistance in northern Gaza, where most of the most severe elements of famine and hunger are being experienced by Palestinians. And they have tried to push to have other UN agencies, the World Food Program, UNICEF, others, to sort of fill in the gap, to take over those responsibilities. The problem is that UNRWA, you know, with its, you know, massive presence, has all of the kind of logistical, you know, kind of hardware and software connections, security personnel that are sort of the backbone of a lot of the humanitarian operations. So I was focusing on a specific case involving an effort by the World Health Organization to get to the Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza after the sort of completion of a sort of devastating Israeli raid. And they were going to evacuate the wounded and to do an assessment of the hospital. They put in requests. What I focused on was the fact that the Israeli government was saying, okay, you can go. There was an approval on April 1st, but you have UNRWA in your convoy. They can't go. And so UNRWA was providing, you know, an armored personnel vehicle, security sort of expertise in this mission. So for more than a week, possibly 2 weeks, WHO was not able to conduct the operation. So it shows you that even though Israel, and with some support, I mean, the U.S. position is a little bit nuanced and complicated. They support UNRWA in some sense, but they have been encouraging the other agencies to try to sort of expand their own roles to address some of the functions that UNRWA currently undertakes. And so, you know, Israel and to an extent U.S. are sort of pushing the other agencies to sort of play this role, but, you know, they don't have all the wherewithal to do it. World Food Program probably has more sort of logistical capacity, but still nothing like this. So it sort of shows that even though there are approvals for other agencies to do this work, they practically can't do it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And I guess, you know, as you've done your reporting, is your sense that if Israel's position remains the same and they continue to thwart UNRWA's access, that this is the kind of set of issues that can be resolved by the other agencies quickly? Like, is this weeks of prep to get their hands on armored, you know, carriers and to get their hands on logistical staff and all the things they would need, you know, maybe from hiring directly from UNRWA? Or is this a more fundamental break where we would be talking about, you know, you need years to build up these capacities? Because I know you mentioned in the piece that Israel has kind of laid out a plan, right? They say UN Habitat should have a role and WHO should have a role and the Red Cross. And they kind of laid out a constellation of international agencies that they think could take the place of UNRWA. But you're saying, hey, that's really hard to do. Do you have a sense of how hard?
So it's a bit of both. I mean, gradually the agencies will get better at sort of fulfilling some of the functions, dealing with security. I mean, World Health Organization ultimately carried out its convoy mission to Al-Shifa. They did it without UNRWA. So, you know, but the one interesting thing is that, you know, where are the other agencies going to get the personnel to do this? They're going to be the same people that are working for UNRWA right now. I mean, there was one of the vehicles on the World Central Kitchen convoy that was hit. One of the vehicles that wasn't struck was involved in UNRWA security personnel who had left UNRWA because he could make a lot more money working for World Central Kitchen. UNRWA tends to pay less than all the other UN agencies and less than international agencies. And so, you know, what you're going to see is a lot of the same people that are working for UNRWA are going to be working for the other agencies. So that's one element. There's also in the Israeli plan, what is noticeable is that they don't mention anything about, say, for instance, education. Probably the primary role that UNRWA plays in Gaza is providing education. About 10,000 of the 13,000 employees are teachers and administrators and that sort of thing. And Israel doesn't have anything. I mean, in the initial plan that I saw that they distributed to governments, it didn't at all refer to education. So some things they can do, others they you know, it's going to be a long, long haul.
And this point you're making about salary is not a minor one, right? I remember from some of your prior reporting that the scale difference between what UNRWA pays and what would be paid at kind of international standard levels is huge. And so if you multiply that across the entire, you know, workforce of 13,000 people, you know, it's an enormous amount of money at a time when, you know, money is also one of the constraints facing this enormous humanitarian challenge.
Yeah, it's like 3 to 4 times as much as like the general kind of figure that they have. And also, I mean, there's the other issues, which you're trying to do this massive transition in the middle of a conflict zone, right? So, you know, it's one thing if, you know, we get to discussions about the day after and maybe you can sort of transition to new structures, but we're in a war situation now. There aren't thousands of, you know, foreign nationals that are going to pour into a war zone to provide humanitarian assistance. You know, UNRWA has people on the ground. They can do certain things, and there just isn't the capacity elsewhere at this, you know, at this moment, at this critical moment.
Yeah, and I mean, it's such a huge challenge. It's not easy to see a way through this. You mentioned in the piece how Israel has a vetting process for truck drivers, and it's really stringent. And so that becomes one of the bottlenecks, because there have been so many bottlenecks along the way. It sounds like that's one of the really big ones. And, you know, it's very hard to figure out how do you get that to move much more quickly, regardless of which agency is sending the trucks.
Right. And there's going to be much more intense vetting coming down the road on all the other UN agencies, which they haven't really experienced up until now. So it's you know, there's still going to be a lot of bureaucratic impediments to free flow of assistance, I think.
Yeah, well, it's a huge story. I'm glad that you're on top of it and appreciate the reporting here, which we will continue to bring to you.
The world is facing a range of health threats, from an increase in disease outbreaks to the health impacts of climate change. I'm Jenilei Ravelo, Senior Global Health Reporter for DevEx. Every Thursday, we bring you exclusive news and insights on how the health sector is finding solutions to these challenges in our free weekly newsletter, DevEx Checkup. Visit devx.com/newsletters to subscribe.
Ode, I'd love to bring you into the discussion, and maybe on the area where you focus a lot of your professional life, which is on localization. We had a couple of interesting pieces this week, you know, one of which is around this idea of nothing about you without you, and a sense that, you know, from some local leaders that, look, there's a big discussion about localization here in the West, but are they really part of it? Are they at the center of it? Or is this people talking about localization, but not really including them with some of the really basic logistical things, a bit like what we were just talking about in the Gaza Strip, affecting this case of like people just not having access, visas being denied to local leaders. I don't know if you had a chance to see that story and hear about this letter that's been circulating, but I'd love to get your take on that and the broader state of localization.
Thank you, Raj. Yeah, I did read the story. And I mean, you know, it was kind of devastating to read, you know, once more, you know, yet another report about the difficulties that people in the South are facing when it comes to accessing decision-making spaces on the international stage. And, you know, the issue that we're seeing with the specific issue of localization is the same that we see globally when we talk about international policy. And frankly, you know, last year, just a few months after launching the Global South in the World Order project, we had a discussion with experts coming from the different regions about how do we access those spaces in the West. I think that, you know, unfortunately, the whole localization debates, we tend to focus on the numbers, you know, how much funding is actually going to the local partners. And then we tend to forget the other aspects of it, among which is the question, how do we shape the conversation and the way that decisions are being taken. And those decisions are being taken most of the time in capital cities in the West, and in particular in Washington, D.C., when we talk about USAID, which is one of the leader in grants and international aid funding across on the planet. And so, you know, the visa issue is only just one tiny issue among all the plethora of challenges and barriers that local, Global South experts in the development sector are facing. The fact that most of these discussions are happening in the West without, and I mean, you know, you, and I'm based in DC, it's quite easy. You know, you look at the think tank industry where those conversations happen, well, we see that there is just a systemic underrepresentation of those voices. And I think it's even worse is that there is this expectation that, well, not an expectation, it's kind of a fait accompli, where, you know, international policy discussions, debates are happening in those think tanks, and they are happening, they're talking about issues that concern the entire planet, right? Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, the Caribbean. And yet, we are in spaces where these discussions are happening in very much closed spaces, closed circles with mostly Americans or Europeans. I mean, just Westerners that really dominate the space. And so that issue of visa, but also the logistic processes, the costs associated to bringing experts from the South in the West when they are invited, because let's be honest, that invitation is certainly not automatic. We are still have so much effort. There is still so much effort that needs to be done there. But when this invitation gets sent to Southern experts, then they have the entire logistic barriers that they need to face. And so when it comes to the localization, I'm quite happy that this letter has circulated, so that we also discuss about these aspects of it. You know, it's not just about the numbers, it's not just about sending the funding. It is also about having these folks being in the room when we talk about how they're going to be impacted by changes in the way that we Western donors provide aid. And frankly, you know, if I can just add just one more point, if we look also at the academia, the development literature, even in that space, it is very much dominated by Western experts. And I think one of the numbers I saw, I think it was dated 2021, it was less than 15% of the literature and studies in academic journals that were written by experts from developing countries.
Yeah, no, those are all great points. And just for people who didn't see the piece or haven't heard about this letter, there's some 1,800 local leaders and organizations that signed it and were demanding that we change this approach and make sure their voices are included. And then about 36 international organizations signed it too. Examples are FHI 360 and the Packard Foundation. And the letter basically says, look, we should ensure and are committed to, if you sign it, that local groups are represented at these events, the kind of events that you're talking about that happen at think tanks like yours. You know, that the people who signed are committed to picking locations for events that make it actually physically possible for people from the Global South to attend. By the way, I happen to think that's a really big challenge, because even locations in the Global South are not necessarily very easy to access from other neighboring countries. Oftentimes flight connections are expensive or difficult, but that's one of the commitments made here, is to consider that and choose those locations carefully. Another one is sponsoring local leaders so they can afford to go, and then translation of the events and the materials and the agendas seems like another obvious one, but that does not often happen. And then involving the local organizations in even developing the idea of the event, and maybe even making them co-hosts to figure out that agenda. So it's not just something created in a place like DC and then people are invited to sit and participate. So that's a bit of what this letter is about for people listening who haven't had a chance to see it. But check out the story if you want kind of the full, in-depth view on what this means and what a bunch of people in the space are saying about it. Ode, I'd love to just get your take on kind of how do you think the localization push itself is going. We have another story from our colleague Miguel Tamanan who analyzed the numbers and essentially said, look, this is, you know, shows us even the names of the local organizations getting the funding, some of which are attached to international organizations, and essentially suggesting we're still quite a long way away from the 25% kind of aspirational goal that was set by USAID for local funding by 2025. What's your view about how this effort is actually going?
Yeah, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I mean, to be frank, I'm quite skeptical about the progress that you know are being made. As you mentioned, right now USAID funding to local partners is just at 8%, and this number needs to be analyzed with the fact that there has been a decrease in U.S. Funding. So really, you know, when we know that technically next year we should have 25% of U.S. funding going directly to local partners, well, clearly we are very far from achieving that. So I'm just, you know, just highly pessimistic about how slowly things are going. I mean, to be sure, it's also important to recognize the fact that, yes, there are some improvements in the way that, you know, Stamina Power has really been pushing for changes to happen. But at the same time, I do believe that Western donors still have not reckoned with the fact that it is the entire system that needs to be changed. It is about procurement processes. It is about how, you know, accepting to give power, sharing power with recipients of international aid, and accepting the fact that, well, that means that programs are likely not to be implemented or designed the way that people in Washington have envisioned it. And that is part of the game, right? I think that we really have this, just the way that we talk about aid. And frankly, my personal take is that at some point we also need to move beyond aid, because it just fosters and feeds in the dependency circles that we're currently seeing. But the way that we think about it continues to be the same. And you know, I have regular discussions with colleagues and friends that are based in Africa, that are African experts working in the development, the policy, the humanitarian fields. And it's always just extremely frustrating to hear the continuing challenges that they face. The issue of localization, again, you know, it's also about the huge discrepancy that we see, for instance, in salaries. I was talking with one of my friends, he was saying that, you know, the salary that he receives being part of an NGO and working in that field is actually less than 10% of what a foreigner would receive in an equal position. This is insane, right? There's just like so many layers of issues that we see with localization. And yet, I kind of find that we do not speak so much about them. We tend to focus on the big issues of how do we empower local actors. And yet we still do not have so much emphasis on these other issues. The other thing is that another aspect, and I recently wrote about that in February, is that the aid as we know it today is very much focused on formal NGOs. When we know that, for instance, I'm going to speak about the African Union because this is my region of focus. But when we know that the informal sector represents a huge part of the economic system, there are also informal champions of change that are struggling to receive funding, that are struggling, that basically are marginalized from the international aid system, and yet that have great impacts in the field. And one of my friends in Senegal, Sidina Ndiaye, he's one of these leaders, and they're doing some great work trying to support informal leaders of change in professionalizing them, in trying to secure funding so that they can have an impact in their communities. And unfortunately, the aid system as we know it simply does not include these actors.
Yeah, I wrote a piece years ago called "How Local Can You Get?" And I do wonder, you know, as we define localization in a certain way now, does that lead to its own side effects down the road where we're basically funding the biggest institutions in the capitals of the global south that maybe have very strong elite founders and lots of connections to the West? And you sort of end up perpetuating a lot of what, you know, the people who are behind this push don't want to see, but they end up kind of being forced into it just given the logistical nature of this work. Colm, you've been following this story for a long time too. And obviously we talk USAID a lot, but this is playing out everywhere. I wonder if you have a thought on where we are in these pieces.
Yeah, I mean, one of the thoughts I have is that the whole sort of localization push, right? So, you know, our politics, like many other countries, are driven to a larger degree by moneyed interest, right? And so a lot of the big Western, you know, aid organizations, independent ones, you know, they have political muscle, right? They've got political pull. I mean, if you look at something like, you know, that during the Trump administration, when, you know, the Trump administration was looking to cut foreign aid across the board, World Food Program, you know, actually saw its aid go up. And they did because they had bipartisan support in Congress, and they had bipartisan support also because there are a lot of very important moneyed shipping and commodities companies that that want to do this and think they need to do this. So when you have, you know, a lot of sort of, you know, what I kind of, my concern is like you have a lot of local organizations that just don't have any muscle, and foreign aid is an easy political target, and all you need are a couple of corruption, you know, cases, which you will find, even if the program is running well. And it's sort of, you know, it's low-hanging fruit for politicians, and it's easy to sort of shift, you know, public support for foreign assistance, right? So that's the one thing, is that, you know, if you're going to sort of really go down this road of localization, how do you build a kind of, you know, a sign of support base politically and economically that, you know, can defend you know, these policies. I kind of keep thinking, you know, if things go bad, it can go bad for the aging. I mean, look at a situation like Gaza right now. The Palestinians don't have a very strong kind of lobby or a, you know, contingency of supporters in Washington. And so, you know, their argument, the argument about, you know, like looking at this in a more nuanced view doesn't really carry much water. It's my sense.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll look back on this and say, you know, we all wanted to see localization happen. You know, development professionals everywhere, including in the global north, it's amazing how many organizations I find are kind of arguing against their own financial interests. They're saying, we don't count as local, even though we have local chapters and local affiliates and you know, don't fund us, fund other truly local groups. But we might all look back, even those who've been pushing for this, and say, boy, we shouldn't have been targeting localization as the goal. We should have been targeting development as the goal, and localization is sort of a means to the end. That if you can show that localization is just much more cost effective because you actually get money in the hands of people who can make real and lasting change, that approach might have led to actually better development outcomes and more localization versus where we are now, potentially. And you know, the jury is still out, but potentially, if you look at, you know, the data in that piece by our colleague Miguel Tabanon, you do have to wonder, well, are all of these organizations truly local? And are we just checking a box, you know, and kind of trying to fulfill a procurement requirement as opposed to really fundamentally changing the way development works, which is, I think, you know, what you were referring to was like, look, we're talking about systemic change that's needed, not just, you know, moving around the pieces on the board.
I totally agree with what you just said, Raj. And actually, you know, I was looking at the list of, you know, top local recipients. And yes, you know, some of them are international NGOs with a branch in the recipient country. So yes, it's, you know, I agree with you with you know, the question whether it just becomes a procurement issue. And as you mentioned, that leads back to the question, how do we change the whole system? At the same time, and you mentioned, you know, how in some situations, some contexts, it is the biggest truly local organizations that that capture most of the funding. And you know, with some of the discussions I've had with some friends, it's exactly what they've been saying, right? It is some, and there was this trope that one of my friend used. He basically said that some of these local organizations have become mastered procurement processes, calls for proposals. They have become master of donors' language, and so they are the one dominating the fields. When smaller organizations that do not necessarily have the same capacity but may have even greater impact are left on the sides. So at the end of the day, you know, I think, you know, there are definitely issues with the way that we define localization, local partners, and so on. But beyond that, I think that there is really a need in capital cities in the West, at major donors level, to truly think about how to change the way that we think about development. I think that's where things need to start from. It's accepting the fact that what people think development should be may not be what people on the ground see in development. And the way that programs are developed, for instance, in DC, may not be what people, in Abuja or in Dakar or I don't know anywhere else see things going, and that doesn't mean that they don't have any solutions. I think, you know, we see it every day. There are tremendous innovators in the South. We have people that have been able to develop system despite all the constraints and challenges that they face. They succeed in implementing change, they succeed in having even small scale scale programs in their communities. And I think it's also, in that way, there is also a need to kind of question the rhetoric that we always go back when it comes to the challenges to localization, which is they don't have the capacities, they don't have the skills. To be sure, the levels of skills and capacities change from a place to another, right? And it is very difficult to compare countries or even within countries, regions and cities. But at the same time, I feel like there are those type of sweeping statements are always being applied to question the whole movement to empower local champions of change. And it kind of needs to be questioned and almost retired, because solutions exist. They may not look like what we are used to, but like, you know, I discuss quite often with my friends that are really struggling to make an impact. And, you know, they are making an impact in terms of professionalizing informal champions of change, in partnering with the legal sector, you know, to really have SOPs, to have document administration procedures and so on and so forth, to be able to capture funding.
Yeah, I think obviously there's so much to this story, and I want to give, as we're running out of time here, I want to give you, Colin, the last word on this or anything else you want to share. But I do want our listening audience to know that this is a theme we've been covering for a long time here at DevX, and the fact we've got a whole campaign around it that we call Roots of Change. And we've been doing lots of great journalism on this topic from all over the world. So if you're interested in the localization topic, check out our Roots of Change series, where we continue to dive really deep. If you want to nerd out on the numbers and on the perspectives, that is a great place to do it. Colin, over to you for any final thoughts.
Thanks. Yeah, so I would just say, you know, I get the sense in this discussion that the skills that are required for doing sort of effective development are different from the skills that are required for raising money for development. And so, you know, people who are entrepreneurial, who are better at telling a story, who are better at fundraising, that's going to be a magnet for money, right? And so, like, the trick is to sort of find ways to bridge those two. This whole discussion is playing out in a period where there's this kind of, seems to me, you know, being here at the UN, this disconnect between all the negotiations, discussions that I'm seeing, you know, in capitals at the UN on the need for restructuring the, you know, financial architecture, you know, bringing more sort of financial resources to countries that are suffering from, you know, the results of climate change, pandemic, etc., and the actual, you know, steps that are being taken by donor countries, which is, you know, pretty much stagnant funding for overseas development assistance, redirecting overseas development assistance to dealing with refugee issues at home, which you saw in the UK, you see in other countries. Sweden, which is one of the largest, you know, per capita donors in the world, you know, is now kind of revamping its whole aid strategy so that it is more closely linked to, you know, Swedish trade interests and also to ensuring that recipients of aid are more in line with Swedish interests. So it's kind of like the discussion, you know, the agreements that everybody's kind of working out in sort of international fora, they just seem really kind of disconnected to the reality of what nation states are doing now, particularly donors.
No, that's a great point. And a lot of those themes are going to come up this coming week here in DC at the World Bank and IMF spring meetings, or the springs, as people often call them. I mean, this week is becoming a bigger week for exactly this conversation, in part for the reasons you cited, Colin. Like the challenges in the world are just getting much bigger, and the resources from bilateral donors are plateauing or going down. And so there's a real need to look to other places. And one of those places are the MDBs, like the World Bank, and another is the private sector. And so you're seeing, you know, here in DC, just people descending from all over the world. The traditional players, ministers of finance, of course, will be here, but also lots of private sector CEOs, some of them part of the private sector investment lab that the World Bank, that Ajay Banga has stood up. but many others too. And all kinds of investors of different stripes and entrepreneurs will be here in DC. There are more and more side events. I can't even keep track of them, probably hundreds at this point, including a huge conference that is put on by the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth and that DevEx is the media partner for. And it's called the Global Inclusive Growth Summit. And that is absolutely worth checking out if it's not on your radar screen. We've got people like Elton John and Melinda French Gates and Megan Rapinoe and Amina Mohammed and Mia Motley. I mean, it's quite a group that will be speaking on broad issues of inclusivity from the US perspective, but from a truly global perspective too. So that's happening this week, as well as many, many other events. And we are, of course, on top of it with a big team of DevEx reporters who are going to be all over town. So if you're interested in that, stay tuned for more of This Week in Global Development next week, where we'll get into that. And pay attention to the Newswire, where we'll have lots of coverage on that and many other topics. So with that, let me just say a huge thank you to our guests this week, to Ode Darnall and to Colin Lynch. Great to be with you both.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Ode. See you soon. Bye.
This has been This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe using the link in the description. To get even more coverage and analysis on the most pressing development issues of the day, become a DevEx Pro member by going to devx.com/membership and signing up. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.